Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, the four-day Republican Party convention kicks off in Cleveland, Ohio. Over the next couple of days, in addition to speeches, Republicans will vote on their party platform. The draft includes calls for building Donald Trump's proposed Mexico-U.S. border wall, putting Bibles in public schools, cracking down on pornography as a public health crisis, LGBT conversion therapy, and an amendment calling for the indiscriminate and immediate disposal of national public lands. The delegates will also vote on Donald Trump's candidacy, making him the presumptive GOP presidential nominee. The ascendancy of Donald Trump has led many Republicans to ask, how did this happen? Many argue that the rise of Trump is leading to the implosion of the grand old party. For months, the so-called party establishment has tied itself in a knot, trying to explain Donald Trump's repeated racist and xenophobic statements, fear-mongering, and nativism, and they're saying that that does not represent the Republican Party and its conservative values. So on today's Your Call, we are spending the hour looking at the Republican Party's shift to the right. Where is the party heading? And what are the roots of the chaos in the party? Today, we're joined by two guests. Michael Winship is an Emmy Award-winning senior writer of Moyers & Company and BillMoyers.com. And one of his latest pieces is called Trump, His Virus, and the Dark Age of Unreason. And Michael joins us from New York. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of several books, including To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And Heather joins us on the phone from Maine. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So, Heather, I understand that you got the idea to write your book about the history of the Republican Party back in the 80s, and it took you 4 years to write. It's a very in-depth look looking at the history of the party. And, you know, I just wonder, what's been your reaction watching Donald Trump completely dominate the media for the last year, and now this week he will be named the Republican presidential nominee? Did you expect this?
Well, I didn't expect Trump necessarily, but I expected somebody like Trump, because what's happened since the 1980s is that the movement conservatives, who really have been trying to overturn the New Deal since the 1940s, have taken over the Republican Party, and they have done it by focusing on racism and sexism and xenophobia, always in coded language. But what they did is they created a constituency that was operating primarily on resentment. And it was only a question of time until that constituency got out of control and of the establishment. And that's certainly what's happened in this election cycle.
When you say movement conservatives, who are you talking about exactly?
Well, if you think about all the way back to World War II, the Republican Party had a couple of options coming out of the New Deal and FDR. And what they could do is they could either say, yeah, we like the idea of government intervention in the economy, we like government regulation, we like social welfare legislation, or they could say, no, that stuff is all wrong, we hate all of it, we want to go back to the 1920s. And that's precisely what happened. The party split in two, with the people holding on to the 1920s being a really small rump group that everybody thought was going to fade away and nobody would never be heard from again. The real power of the party seemed to be with the Eisenhower wing, which developed a new kind of republicanism that we would now call moderate republicanism or Rockefeller republicanism, or more recently, RINOs, Republicans in name only, which is really a misnomer because they were the heart of the party. But the people who hated that idea of government intervention in the economy, of government regulation, of businesses, gradually took over the party by arguing that an activist government redistributed wealth from white people to black people. And they pointed to Brown v. Board of Education, to Eisenhower sending the troops into Little Rock, and later on to any kind of legislation that helped African-American communities as evidence of that. And gradually that really took off, especially in the South and in the far West. And those people who called themselves movement conservatives with a capital M and a capital C gradually took over the Republican Party. and eventually purged it of the moderates, the people who, coming out of World War II, looked like they would dominate the 20th and the 21st century.
It's so interesting because President Obama, in an interview a couple of years ago, said that during the Eisenhower era, he would be considered an Eisenhower Republican. He called himself that. And it's just easy to forget that RINOs, Republican in name only, actually dominated the party at one time. I mean, they were also, and we'll talk about this later, but they were very pro-choice.
They were very pro-choice, and people always forget, when we look at today's race relations, people always forget that the Supreme Court that decided the Brown v. Board of Education decision, which outlawed segregation, was a unanimous decision, and it was headed by a former governor of California, Earl Warren, who was a Republican and who had been appointed by a Republican president. This was the moment that we are in now was not foreordained. It really was constructed by this small group of people who took over the Republican Party and led us down this rabbit hole, if you will, to where we are now.
Michael,
yeah.
We'll talk more about the history, but what are your thoughts? I mean, you've written a lot of articles about Donald Trump. When you look back at all of the media coverage, the wall-to-wall 24/7 coverage he got last year, a lot of people laughed about Donald Trump, and here we are. He's going to be the presidential nominee for the Republican Party. Are you surprised by this?
Well, I very much like Heather, I think that this kind of result was inevitable given the evolution of the Republican Party over the last few decades. Not that it was specifically going to be Donald Trump, but if you look at some of the other candidates like Ted Cruz, for example, they clearly were going increasingly far to the right. And, you know, as Heather says, as the roots of this go back to the New Deal, but it's been building for a long time indeed. And I'm, you know, within my living memory, I'm old enough to remember 1964 and Barry Goldwater and the fight between those two wings of the party that year, where you had Goldwater versus people like Nelson Rockefeller, who was the governor of my home state then, and William Scranton, the governor of Pennsylvania. And there was that divide that she refers to. And you also had the aspect of it with the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which, you know, my writing partner, Bill Moyers, Bill tells the story of Johnson saying to him when he signed the act that they had lost generations of Democratic voters to the Republican Party as a result of that document.
So, Heather, what else stands out for you when you look at the history? The Republican Party has been in existence for 160 years, and you write about the party going back and forth between its moderate and conservative phases. What really stands out for you, and what would you compare to what the Republican Party is dealing with today?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm going to take this in maybe a little bit of a different direction than you might be expecting. And what fascinates me right now is there's plenty of stuff to say about the presumptive nominee, who, by the way, does not yet have the nomination, but the presumptive nominee, Trump, and, you know, where he came from and what he represents. And we've covered that to some degree, but what this means for the party seems to me to be maybe a little bit different than people are looking at. And that is that the Republican Party has, in fact, been at a place very similar to where it is right now a couple of times in the future. Now, we haven't really had a Trump figure within the party, unless you look all the way back to Andrew Johnson, who looks very much like Trump. Andrew Johnson was the president who took over after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. That's a different story. But the question for right now is, where does this take the Republican Party? And rather than arguing that the party is dead, I actually think that this is a sign that the party is being reborn. That is, the Republican Party in its current incarnation is not tenable. This is not an American party right now. It doesn't represent American values. It doesn't represent the traditional ideology of either the Democratic or the Republican parties. It represents a fringe movement. And when that happens, as it's happened before in American society in the 1920s and the 1890s, what happens is the younger people who really believe in the party and believe in its ideology of a social and economic and a political web in America rejuvenate, and they recreate a party that focuses on the idea of equality of opportunity and of using the federal government to advance inequality of opportunity.
Well,
and
it comes
that
out,
happens. Go ahead.
Heather, it goes right back to the very birth of the Republican Party coming out of the Whigs.
the Republicans then, and then the exact same thing happened in 1884 when the party nominated a corrupt senator that many people couldn't stomach, so they slipped to the Democrats. And when that happened, younger people within the party said, geez, we can't be Democrats, but we can rebuild this party. And those people who were ignored in 1884 because they were young and foolish turned out to be Robert La Follette, fighting Bob La Follette, Henry Cabot Lodge, Albert Beveridge, and that guy named Theodore Roosevelt, who ended up rebuilding the Republican Party and making it the Progressive Republican Party. So, you know, I think we're looking at five really rocky years in America, but I actually predict a Progressive Party and a new Republican Party and a new era coming out of this moment.
I hope you're right. I mean, I think, you know, they were warned 4 years ago. They were told this when Mitt Romney was defeated. They went and did a study that told them that they had to be better about organizing the Hispanic vote, for example, and they just, they just totally ignored that. So I think you're right. I think that has to happen.
You know who really said it was Eisenhower. He called out Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley Jr. in spades way back in the 1950s and the 1960s. He said this is exactly what's going to happen. And the man was prescient. We're exactly where he said we were going to end up.
Heather Cox Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. We're also joined by Michael Winship, an Emmy Award-winning senior writer of Moyers & Company and BillMoyers.com. And today we are talking about the history of the Republican Party, the current state of the party, and we're talking about its future. What questions or comments do you have if you are a Republican or a former Republican, if you would be considered a rhino today? We'd love to hear from you. Do you agree with Heather that maybe young people will stand up to recreate the Republican Party? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org.
You know, Rosa,
there's
one thing that Teddy Roosevelt, as wonderful and progressive as Teddy Roosevelt was, there was one thing that he shared with Donald Trump, which is that it was said of Teddy Roosevelt that he wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. And I think we can certainly ascribe that same quality to Trump.
Well,
and they used to complain that they had to get rid of all the eyes in the typesetting because they had to get more eyes because he used up all the eyes every time he wrote anything.
Heather, I mean, how do you explain how far to the right the party has moved? I mean, when you look at Richard Nixon, for example, and all of the incredible environmental laws that passed under Nixon, and then you look at the Republican Party today, denying climate change, bringing a snowball onto the floor of, it was the House or the Senate, and saying, look, climate change doesn't exist. And then when you look at abortion, and we can talk more specifically about it later in the show, but George H.W. Bush's grandfather was a huge proponent of Planned Parenthood. And now you have someone like Mike Pence, who is going to be Donald Trump's vice president. I mean, his abortion views are so extreme that even anti-abortion politicians in Indiana wouldn't sign on to a bill that he signed that barred women from seeking an abortion because the fetus has a disability. I mean, the other presidential candidates opposed abortion even in cases of rape and incest. I mean, this was not the case just 8 years ago. So how do you describe how far to the right this party has moved?
Well, I ascribe it to the way that movement conservatives have retained power in the face of the fact that they are advancing principles that are policies that are actually unpopular. Americans like to have clean water. They like to have schools. They like to have roads. So how do you advance, and they like to have the government regulate business. So how do you advance an ideology that says all of those things are wrong in a democracy? Well, what you do is you advance a narrative, and I'm sure Michael can speak to this as a writer. You advance a narrative that says that the world is divided between good people and bad people, and we're the good people, and those bad people are destroying the country. And the way you get to the extremes that we're in now is that original language came, of course, out of 1964, out of the movement conservatives originally, but then out of 1964 and Barry Goldwater and the conservatives who insisted that they were the good Americans with a capital C, that's why they call themselves movement conservatives, was to say that they were a group who stood against liberals, capital, which they called with a capital L to make it look like an organized cabal like communism, and that they stood against liberals. And liberals were anti-American, and they were godless, and they were trying to redistribute wealth. Well, once you've divided the world between us and them, you have to continue to demonize your opponent until you get to the point where, by definition, anything your opponent says is wrong. Even as in now, we have the case where climate change is simply not negotiable. I mean, we know it's happening, unless you are willing to move into what is, you know, essentially a post-factual world, which is where movement conservatives live nowadays. It's a world of extremes, and it's a world of extremes that inevitably, when you get to that point, when you are this post-factual, if you will, you know, a reference there back to the Karl Rove, who assured a reporter that he lived in the in a world in which he could create his own reality. When you get that far down that road, you end up at a place where it's not believable for a majority of people. And for me, that moment happened this year in the debates when Carly Fiorina talked about Democrats killing babies and selling their body parts. Mm. That's an extremist kind of language that will only appeal to people who are so ideologically invested in the idea of us versus them that they are literally willing to believe that major figures in America are cutting up babies and selling their body parts. And, you know, the roots of this narrative are very powerful. They're in dividing the world so you can whip up a group of people without using facts. But within that lies its own destruction, because you have to get more and more extreme, as Donald Trump has gotten more and more extreme, until you get to the point where even people who might have been on your team say, look, I don't really believe that the Secretary of State is cutting up babies and selling body parts. So I think we got there by the use of this language to whip up people to act against their own interests.
And Michael, this is why the media are so important.
Well, yeah.
Right? And Heather points out the Republicans have managed to use the media far, far more effectively than the Democrats. Can you talk about that,
well,
Michael?
Actually, I was going exactly to that point, and Heather gave and you gave the perfect segues to it, but just basically that with the vast changes in the media, with the 24/7 news cycle, and also with this whole sort of niche aspect of news now, where you seek out the news that basically parallels and reflects your own political views, and then it feeds upon it, and it gets worse and worse and worse, so that you've got the Fox News is on the right, and you've got even like MSNBC toward the left. You've got these places where people go to get the news that they want to hear that basically backs up what they believe, and then it just continues to feed and amplify those beliefs.
Heather, what are your thoughts about the media's role?
Well, actually, let me throw that one back to you, though, Michael. We certainly have the niche media, which is a huge problem with the end of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987.
Exactly.
The idea that people had to represent both sides of an issue. But here's my thought on that. I wonder about this. In the 1960s, first the Republican Party and then the Democratic Party wedded themselves to political science with the idea that you won elections by slicing and dicing the electorate, that the story didn't matter anymore so long as you could convince, you know, a certain population that they wanted this bridge or they wanted this piece of legislation. So what they did is they, both the Republican and the Democratic Party, stopped telling national stories, stories that said, you know, America stands for equality or for, you know, home and motherhood, whatever. And what they did when they took that story away is they left the door open for the movement conservatives to really put in this almost cartoonish version of America that's the good guys against the bad guys. I mean, it's really no accident that you get Star Wars in 1977 and then Reagan elected in 1980, I think. If you look at the Star Wars story, it's very much, you know, sort of the little guy against the empire, you know, the same kind of story that Reagan was telling, which is a very simplistic story. And one of the things that I've been fascinated about on this turn is that both Trump and Bernie Sanders advance narratives, and in a way, they have forced Secretary of State Clinton to go ahead and people on the left to go ahead and really articulate what they believe America should be, as opposed to saying, yeah, we can do this for this population, or we can do this for this population. They're really starting to say America believes in equality, it believes in fairness, it believes the color of your skin shouldn't matter, it believes that you know, the very rich should not take everything. And to me, that's one of the major redefinitions of this political era.
Well,
what do you
think,
Michael? Does that work?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I do think, however, that on a purely logistic level, the Republicans and the right wing of the Republican Party has certain tactical advantages that the Democrats have lost over the last few years, and that's largely through the down ballot races in the state legislatures and the resulting gerrymandering of the congressional districts and so forth. So that you've got, while we've been paying attention to these national stories, and I agree with you that it's an important aspect of all this, we've also had a very careful and very calculated taking over of state legislatures in the country by the Republican Party, and subsequently those legislatures being able to gerrymander congressional districts when the census results have come out every 10 years. And I think that's given them a very strong advantage that often overcomes even these national stories.
And that was quite a concerted effort. That was you people wrote about that. I forget what it was called.
The Powell Memorandum? Yeah.
No, the Powell Memorandum for sure, but Operation Red Map, right?
Oh, sure,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, we did a show about this. It's a book called Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy with David Daley. And he said the Democrats were completely asleep at the wheel when all of this happened at the state level.
Well, and Dave, having been the editor of Salon, where Heather and I have both written... and now has got this great book on gerrymandering that you're talking about, yeah.
Heather, can you talk a little bit more about media, though, on this issue? Because we often hear that Washington is broken, both sides can't get along. I mean, this is the line that we hear over and over again. It's very simplistic, and in many cases, it's just not true, if you really dig down and find out who's actually holding legislation hostage.
I think there's a lot going on. I don't think it's just the media, but we have a tradition in America for over 100 years that the media is going to be neutral, that it's going to report the facts, that it's going to be independent. And the problem with that is that there is, among reasonable people, the idea that if there is one side to a story, there must be another side. And there is, if you put to that media idea together with sort of the cultural ideas coming out of the 70s and the 80s, the idea almost, if you will, of, I don't want to say cultural relativism, but certainly social relativism. That is, if I say something, your point of view is just as legitimate. The problem with that is a very easy system to play. And we saw it played really dramatically in America with Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s, Senator Joe and McCarthyism, who really was himself a movement conservative, but really gave a blueprint for how to manage the media to people who really did not believe in the use of facts to move an argument. The idea that if you throw enough stuff at the wall and you keep moving the conversation to the right, that in order to sound legitimate, a news organization is going to have to continue to give airtime to that kind of an argument. The idea that, you know, if I say there is climate change, it's only fair to say somebody else should have airtime to say there isn't. But the problem with that is, while that's ingrained in the American media and it comes out of a very specific moment at the turn of the last century, it's very easy then for people who are pushing an agenda to say, wait a minute, you're not being fair because you're not including my point of view. Well, my point of view might be that Martians have taken over Congress, but that doesn't make it legitimate just because it's my point of view. And finally, again, in this news cycle, we're seeing people calling in real time the language and the ideas that Republicans are pushing illegitimate. They're saying, you know, this has never happened. This is not true. But we have not had a space in American media since the turn of the last century for reporters, editors for certain in editorial pages, but reporters to say, this factually is untrue. And now we finally are starting to push back on that, and it's high time. But there is structurally within the media a problem with doing that.
It's exactly what you're saying. It's these false equivalencies that arise. But it's also this sort of notion of magical thinking that because people are so dedicated to the Fox News, for example, and all they're getting is this steady diet of this stuff, that when somebody with a lot of credibility, somebody like Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann, come out and say, no, look, the fact of the matter is, it is the Republicans. It is the Republican Party that's causing this gridlock in Congress. This is the problem. This is the reality. And people go, no, it isn't.
Right. Norm Ornstein from the American Enterprise Institute, right, a conservative who's been trying to get that message out.
Yeah.
But he's having a hard time.
Oh, yeah.
After the break, let's talk more about this, because, Michael, in one of your articles, you compare Trump to Senator Joseph McCarthy, and you write that a very brave journalist called him out on the same airwaves that helped the senator become so powerful. It was Edward R. Murrow. And if you compare that today, the media bring out the Tea Party, Trump, Cruz, and so many conservatives without exposing them for their views, their racist views, anti-immigrant views. The list goes on. So we'll talk more about that. Today we're joined by Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Michael Winship is an Emmy Award-winning senior writer of Moyers & Company and BillMoyers.com. Today we are talking about the state of the Republican Party. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you prefer to write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org, leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Coming up in a half an hour here on KLW, it's Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the protests that are taking place during the Republican and Democratic national conventions. Tens of thousands of people are expected to take to the streets. In Cleveland, where the Republican convention is taking place, 10,000 plastic handcuffs have been purchased, jail cells have been emptied, and courts will be open until 1 a.m. So we'll take a look at how activists are responding and what is going to happen on the streets. Wednesday, we will take a break from the convention and we'll be joined by Jules Boykoff to talk about his new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. And then Thursday, we will talk about Donald Trump, his policies, and what his history tells us about where he stands on a number of issues. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the history of the Republican Party, the current state of the party, and where it's going. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio. What are your thoughts on the Republican Party? Where it, like Heather said, it used to be run by the rhinos, the Republicans in name only. Now it's very extreme. The platform includes Bibles in public schools, LGBT conversion therapy, an amendment calling for the immediate disposal of national public lands. Almost all of the Republicans running for president opposed abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. Politicians wouldn't even touch that 8 years ago, and now they're fully embracing it. Today we're joined by Michael Winship, Emmy Award-winning senior writer of Moyers & Company and BillMoyers.com, and Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of several books, including To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And I wanted to ask you both about the different factions of the party and how that has changed over the years. Heather, or Michael, actually, let's start with you. There was an interesting story in the New York Times a couple days ago about how the business elite are not comfortable with Donald Trump.
Right.
The Business Roundtable said they loved Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney knew all of them on a first-name basis. And these are mostly men, CEOs of major American corporations. They said none of them know Donald Trump, and they're not going to stump for him. So let's talk a little first about corporate America and its changing relationship with the Republican Party and how it aligns or doesn't align with, say, the conservative wing, the religious wing, and like the Tea Party, for example.
Well, I'm sorry. Heather, did you want to jump in? I'm happy to.
No, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
No, well, I was going to say, first of all, that a lot of this has to do with the larger issue that impacts both parties is just the sort of taking over of the two-party system by corporate America in terms of the money that it puts into campaign finance, and also the lobbying industry, which is this, you know, has become this billions and billions of dollars worth of business that sells influence, that peddles influence on Capitol Hill and in the state capitals as well and in cities, so that you've got, you know, a system whereby Hillary Clinton is much more comfortable with a lot of the big business people than in fact Donald Trump is. And this is a problem. It's why we need campaign finance reform. It's why we need to overthrow Citizens United. And all these things have allowed this to happen, so that you have a system whereby Hillary Clinton, you know, over the decades of her political career and working with her husband and her husband's two terms in the White House, became much more pro-business than the Democratic Party has been. Now, there are some people who say that was partly because of the diminishing of the labor movement in America, that a lot of that money from labor that was so essential to Democratic politics has gone down in amount, and so that the centrists in the Democratic Party turned to business to recover those funds. But it's a definite thing, and it's affected both parties.
Well, and then you pick up why people who support the idea of business and government would not support Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at his policies and you look at, for example, his take on the debt and some of his ideas, anybody who's interested in the stability of the U.S. debt, which even though most people don't pay a lot of attention to it, everybody is interested in the sanctity of the U.S. debt.
Mm-hmm.
They look at Trump and they look at his policies and they look at how destabilizing he would be. And you think it fascinates me, because this might very well be the moment when when financiers especially, but financiers and big business people switch sides and begin to support the Democrats. And it's interesting because they had a very similar moment in 1872, when the Democrats, who had always had the loyalty of the financial interests in the country, were so crazy on financial issues, and especially on the debt question, that Wall Street jumped ship from the Democrats and switched to the Republicans, and they have never switched back.
Mm.
And this might be the moment when they flirted with Kennedy, of course, but this might be the moment when they switch back, simply because of the two candidates, regardless of how you feel about Senator Clinton, you have to realize that she is the person who's going to bring stability to financial markets before somebody like Donald Trump.
Well, and she also has very close ties to Wall Street. Back in April, Charles Koch, one of the Koch brothers, said that Hillary Clinton could possibly be a better nominee than Donald Trump.
Yeah,
and the Koch brothers would be terrified of having Trump in power. Again, he's just too, he's not a politician, he's a salesman, and he is completely erratic. And the last thing you want to do if you're investing money is to have somebody in charge who's completely erratic, unless you're a short-term investor who's planning to get in and get out and take your money and hide it under a rock somewhere, which most of these guys aren't.
I was going to say something very similar, which is I think that, in fact, these businessmen and businesswomen who look at what's happening with Trump have a fairly good sense of how he does business, and these sort of buccaneering ways he has, and the ways that he has screwed up on contracts and his bankruptcies and everything else, and they look at that and they just cringe.
He's the person you want to have on your team to be the hatchet man, not the person you want to have head your team, because any team headed by a hatchet man goes down in flames fast.
Well, and we'll talk more about Donald Trump and where he stands on these issues on Thursday. I mean, in some cases, he sounds like Bernie Sanders on trade, but then some people say, well, he changes his mind so regularly, it's hard to know where he really does stand on these issues.
So he's a salesman closing the deal.
Right.
You know, he'll say whatever it takes to close that particular deal. And, you know, the idea of even discussing his policies, aside from the policy that Donald Trump is the best person on earth, I don't think he has a policy.
Well, we'll definitely talk about that more on Thursday. Heather, what else would you say about these different factions of the Republican Party? So you have, you know, the very anti-immigrant, white, working class Donald Trump supporters. You have the more religious group that's very focused on abortion, overturning Roe v. Wade. You've got the corporate wing. What are your thoughts about how the party deals with those three factions, and how has that changed over time?
Well, I think the change over time is the answer to how it's playing out today, personally. But of course, you know, I'm a historian, so of course I say that. The problem with movement conservatism is that it is advancing an idea beginning in the 1930s and the 1940s that is essentially unpopular. How do you sell the deregulation of business to a country that likes the regulation of business? Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is, as I say, by dividing the world between us and them. And that works in the era of desegregation because you can rile up especially Southern and far Western voters against the idea of the government doing anything for African Americans. That's good for a while. But the problem is, even in the Reagan administration, the idea of supply-side economics was not popular even within Reagan's own administration. They had their real doubts about it. Some people were true believers, but others were not. And after the 1986 tax cuts, Reagan was determined to cement those tax cuts, even though, as you know, the deficit and the debt were tripling, were blooming. I mean, the idea that somehow there was a Reagan miracle that was not funded by deficit spending is, you know, kind of crazy. But that was the idea to push. And in order to maintain those tax cuts, Reagan and his supporters turned to the idea of mobilizing new voters, people who traditionally did not vote or who voted Democratic. And the people they went after were what they called the values voters, and they actively encouraged evangelicals and religious voters to come into the fold in the Republican Party beginning in the late 1980s, really in 1986. They don't really share the same business ideas or even necessarily racial resentments as the other two groups. So the way you pull all those people together is, again, under this umbrella of there are good Americans who believe in no business regulation, who don't believe in social welfare legislation, and who believe in home and motherhood. And then there are the people on the other side, and they are, by definition, anti-American and are dangerous. And that construction really has worked really since the 1980s. But the problem, again, is that the people who were in charge of the government could not really deliver on any of the promises that they were making, except the deregulation of business, which in fact destroyed both the people who had racial resentments and the people who had cultural resentments, you know, pulled the rug out from underneath them economically. And I'm sure Michael will can cite the statistics more clearly than I can, but beginning in 1980, wealth redistributed dramatically in America, but it went upward, mm-hmm. not downward.
Yeah.
So now you have this moment where, in fact, the same policies that benefit people of means are destroying the voters who are putting people of means in power. And I think we're hitting not an implosion, but rather an explosion, where people who recognize that whatever their feelings are about abortion or about people of color or whatever, have been absolutely wiped out in the last generation. The middle class is no more, and
right.
that this is the moment when they realize that.
And I think fear is just an incredibly potent and powerful weapon, and that it just stomps out reason. And that's what we're seeing.
Right, and you're seeing a lot of people. The New York Times, for example, has done good reporting on this. People who are really hurting are not making ends meet and flocking to Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And there's also this age-old, I mean, and Heather, as an historian, can address this better than I, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, this goes all the way back to the beginnings of the nation, where there's always been this aspirational thing that, you know, you can look to somebody like a Donald Trump and say, and someone like that, and say, well, look at A, look at how successful he is and can pass that on to the government, and B, you know, there's always a shot that I could become that rich guy.
But there is this one weird piece right now, and that is that one of the things that the Republicans have done and that Donald Trump is really doubling down on is the delegitimization of the government.
Mm-hmm.
That is the idea that the government is so corrupt that, you know, Clinton is incredibly corrupt, although, again, she's been cleared again and again and again, and that the Republicans are corrupt, that everybody is corrupt, and therefore people should not turn to the government for solutions the way they have in the past, saying the government must keep the playing field level so the people at the bottom can rise as well as the people at the top. Instead of going with that, they're going with the idea of a strong man coming in from outside. And
mm-hmm.
that's a new moment. Because in the past, when Americans have looked around themselves and said, hey, wait a minute, very few people are taking everything. We've got to use the government to level the playing field here and to change the laws so that the very rich don't control everything. They've actually had movements that take back the government. In this case, that impulse seems to be moving outside the government and looking for an authoritarian figure that will do it in place of the government. And that, I think, is new in America. When it's happened before, the people who espoused it really didn't manage to get very far in the way that Trump has. You think of somebody like the America First movement in the 1920s, for example. They were there, but they didn't get much traction. Trump has gotten that traction from outside, and that is, I think, a new moment in America and a very concerning one.
And Michael, what would you say? Because you wrote about this.
Well, I think that this constant drumbeat, I mean, going back to the media, and there's this constant relentless drumbeat about this, and where it is Trump all the time and so forth, and where it confirms people's worst fears and base fears, and it's taken us to where we are right now.
Michael Winship is an Emmy Award-winning senior writer of Moyers & Company and BillMoyers.com. Heather Cox Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College and author of several books, including To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about the Republican Party, if you're a Republican, former Republican, if you have friends or family members who are Republicans, what are your thoughts about how the party got to where it is and where it's going? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Leslie writes in, she writes, yours in despair. She says, I agree that the party has essentially created Donald Trump in the years since 1980. As the Stop Trump folks know only too well, he is not a Republican, much less a conservative. He's an apolitical demagogue, the candidate of the party of me. Leslie, I hope you can tune in on Thursday because we're going to talk specifically about Trump. She also says, the Republican Party may recreate itself if Trump loses. But if he wins, the damage to the country, the world, and the planet precludes any consideration of what might happen afterwards. Heather, what are your thoughts on that?
I think she nailed it, don't you?
Yep.
What do you think, Michael?
No, I agree. I totally agree. I think it's very perceptive and dead on.
And also, given the fact that the Republicans dominate across the country, I mean, they're passing so many laws, anti-choice laws, for example, and in Congress. Heather, you said earlier that young people will recreate the party. Why would they change course at this point?
Well, now that's an interesting question, and maybe this one's more for Michael than for me. The Republicans do very well on state levels. But where they have really managed to put in place their ideology unvarnished, if you will, states like Kansas and North Carolina and to some degree Wisconsin, they're not popular, in fact. Their popularity has depended on policies that tend to be more moderate. And one of the things that my children keep pointing out to me is the demographics involved here, that the staunch Republican voters tend to be much older, white and male, and it was just about a year ago that millennials outnumbered baby boomers demographically for the first time in America, and that, of course, is only going to be more and more strongly skewed as each month passes. What do you think, Michael? State versus national?
I think that backing up exactly the point you were making is the fact that you look at somebody like Mike Pence as governor of Indiana, and his popularity is you know, in the cellar. And the same thing with Chris Christie. The people in his own state, he's got like something like a 29% popularity rating. And it's almost like, you know, P.J. O'Rourke, the conservative humorist, is fond of saying that Republicans insist that government doesn't work and then get elected to prove it. And I think that's what we've seen on the state level, that in a lot of places like North Carolina, as you say, when they actually try and implement their policies and put their ideology to practical use, it's a dismal failure.
Well, so then going back to the media, I mean, in one of your article, you compare Donald Trump to Senator Joseph McCarthy, and
yeah,
you point out, and this is so important at a time when, you know, the media is really in a crisis here. Edward R. Murrow came out on the same airwaves that helped the senator become a powerful national sensation and said, you need to stand up to this.
Well, I think that, yeah, absolutely. And I think that one aspect that's sort of holding back the prospective Murrows at the moment is the fact that we have this so much more vastly diffuse media than we used to have. I mean, when Murrow went on the air, we only had three networks, four if you count the Dumont network, and radio, and there was not, that was what broadcast media was all about. And it wasn't just Murrow. I mean, I think we also have to remember the fact that there was Joe Welch, who was the chief counsel to the Army, going up against McCarthy in one of his investigations, and it was Welch who on television said, you know, "Have you no sense of decency, sir," at long last. And if people want to see that, there's a terrific documentary that Emile D'Antonio made a number of years ago called Point of Order, which I think you can view online, which is a record of the McCarthy Army hearings, and you can see Welch. And the other thing that happened that we're not seeing at the moment is that, you know, Republicans stood up and said, I mean, you've got a handful of Republicans who are saying that Trump is bad, but you've got a whole larger number of Republican senators who are doing handstands and backflips trying to avoid coming out and saying what their position is one way or the other. When McCarthy finally was put down, it was in part because senators, including a lot of brave Republicans, voted to censure him by a vote of 67-22. Hmm. You know, and I don't think we're seeing that kind of, you know, profile and courage in the GOP right now.
Well, we did a show about why Edward Snowden leaked all of those documents the way he did it, and it's because Thomas Drake, a conservative who worked for the NSA, did it 10 years earlier, but he went up the chain of command and got crushed for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this new book by his name just escaped me. I'll get it in a minute. But points out that members of the CIA and the NSA that are blowing the whistle are conservatives.
Mm.
But we're just not hearing that much in the media.
Well, interesting.
Mark Hertzgard's new book. Yeah.
There is also the point about the media now that there are plenty of voices who have been standing against Trump and against the movement conservatives and against their stance on especially women's issues for a very long time. But we are, again, I think with the demonization of capital L liberals and the idea of people standing against the movement conservatives, we are in an especially nasty moment, so that if there are women or people of color who speak up in the media, on Twitter, in blogs, they get just vituperative and hate-filled death threats, all kinds of pushback on any kind of ideas like that. And that really has flown under the radar screen unless people are looking at things like Gamergate, and Gamergate opens up the door to everything else that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But that has really helped to silence voices. And I would argue, having studied Reconstruction, that it's a form of terrorism to stop these voices from speaking, because you are putting them in terror for their lives or their children's lives, is a moment that historians will look at now and say, this is one of the reasons these people were able to go as far as they could, because they were bullies and they shut up the people who disagreed with them. And that's, you know, I'm actually, for all my complaints about the media, people are trying. It's
yeah.
just hard if you're putting your voice out there and somebody is saying, I won't repeat stuff, but if somebody is threatening you physically, it's hard to decide to get up the next day and do it again.
Yeah, and it's a combination. It's the misogyny is so blatant and so virulent, and also the anti-Semitism is just extraordinary.
And you know, my black friends who communicate in the media, some of them have had to have FBI protection.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy. It's
well,
crazy.
You know, I wrote
America,
a piece
in the 21st century.
I wrote a piece last week called "I May Not Know Much, But I Know Why Black Lives Matter," and some of the. Oh, my God, I can't even, you know, begin to tell you some of the stuff I've gotten back.
Wow. Well, so you have combined with the fact that, you know, the CBS CEO Les Moonves told investors, keep going, Donald, you're just making so much money for us. This is incredible.
Yeah, that's the difference between the CBS of today and the CBS of Edward R. Murrow, when, for the most part, he had Bill Paley, who was the head of the company, backing him up.
Right. Heather, I know that so many people have asked you if you're going to write a book about the Dems, but I'm just wondering, how has the Republicans moving further to the right, legitimizing perspectives from the margins? Because let's remember, 70-80% of the public actually supports Roe v. Wade, even though so many of these prominent Republicans now want to overturn Roe. How has that influenced the direction of the Democrats?
Well, the Democrats have slid right as well, and that is, of course, in part a deliberate attempt on the part of the Republicans with their embrace of what was called the Overton window, the idea that if you keep pushing as legitimate more and more extreme positions, you will move the entire window of public discourse to the right. And it worked. I mean, it really did work. So it's brought the Democrats over, but it's funny. I actually pitched the idea of writing a history of the Democrats and was told that it would not be considered interesting right now, and the person that I pitched it to told me that not to write the Republican book a decade ago when I wanted to, so I'm going to listen to her. I'm writing again about the Republicans. But what's interesting is the Democrats and the Republicans have extraordinarily different ideologies, and people tend to forget that. The Democrats rose in the early 19th century at a specific moment in which they created a party around the idea, if you will, of there being a limited pie with us, the haves versus the have-nots, and the understanding that the haves were always trying to get more. So the Democrats have really stood for trying to stop the haves from taking everything over. In effect, they have the world divided in two. The Democrats rose about 30 years later, approximately, in the run-up to the Civil War, and they came up with, if you will, a more social web theory of the way the country should work. And they don't invent it themselves. They take it from a lot of different places. But their idea is that if people at the bottom do well, then they will produce more than they consume, and so they will employ people at the middle, and they, in turn, will employ people at the top, and vice versa. If people at the top do well, they will employ people at the bottom, and there is a circle, a social and economic and political web that will continue to grow so long as nobody exercises undue influence. The problem, of course, is that ideology is very easy for people at the top to take over and use for their own benefit, which is what we're seeing right now. So what we have in America is the need for both of those ways of looking at the world. The Democrats are incredibly useful at times like this when people at the top get way too much power. But the Republican vision of a social and a cultural and economic web is also a valuable way to look at the world. So the present moment has pushed the Democrats farther to the right. It's really made them the central power, but it hasn't changed their fundamental ideology. Hmm. If we got a real Republican Party back, embracing that original ideology, the Democrats would move back to where they should be, which is more to the left than they are now, and providing a much clearer definition, if you will, that bifurcated world as opposed to the web world of the Republicans.
But just to add to Heather's point, I mean, you were talking, Rose, a lot about the Republican primary, but the Democratic platform, in fact, is the most progressive they've had in years, and that's largely because of the Bernie Sanders people.
Right, and we talked about that last week. Michael Winship is a writer with Moyers & Company, and Heather Cox Richardson is author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the planned protests during the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Tens of thousands of civil rights, anti-poverty, and anti-war activists are expected to take to the streets. In Cleveland, where the Republican convention takes place this week, as many as 10,000 plastic handcuffs have been purchased, jail cells have been emptied, and courts will be open until 1 a.m. So how are activists on the ground planning? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.